Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Meiser, Game Wisdom's owner and lead writer. Joining me this week, as always, my co-host, sites designer and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Ulm.
Hey there.
All right, so for this week, we decided to do something a little bit different. We're going to try basically having a little debate about game design and such, and we're going to be calling this podcast a head-to-head. And the topic that we're going to be discussing is gameplay versus narrative. And this is sort of built off of a discussion Kenneth and I had at the beginning of this week regarding Bioshock Infinite. We got on the subject of the game and got into a heated debate at 3 o'clock in the morning, which was really fun, wasn't it, Ken?
Yes. I didn't realize how in-depth we got, because I was kind of doing something else, and then I went back to the chat. So went back and forth, but after a while it became like all my attention went to that chat.
Mm-hmm. Yep, so basically the issue is on the subject of gameplay versus the narrative or the experience. And for this cast, we're not going to basically spoil anything about Bioshock Infinite directly. So, the subject of our conversation was, I felt that Bioshock Infinite as a game was more on the lacking side, or I would say maybe average to below average in terms of gameplay. And Ken argued on the side of the experience, or how the narrative and the story and art, those elements elevated Bioshock Infinite above the actual gameplay.
Right, and it's all perspective, honestly. Because do you respect a game for its gameplay alone or as an experience? For me, like, especially Bioshock and those games similar to it, I'm there to be immersed. And that's a big thing. And the gameplay itself, even though it was, say, lacking, it was still adequate. And to me, it didn't hurt the gameplay. But there is a disconnect, as you mentioned previously, between the narrative and how violent the game can get.
Mm-hmm. And for me, as someone who spends all his time basically analyzing game mechanics and systems, those issues I brought up in my analysis, basically, they just stood out, you know, as sore thumbs in my experience of the game as someone who comes from that background. Like, I found the shooting just to be very average, and it just seemed like they spent all this time building the story, building this art style, and not enough time on the actual gameplay.
Right, and I also feel like it was more of an afterthought kind of thing. You could make connections to the previous game with the concept of plasmids in Vigors, but again, Vigors felt like they're kind of just pushed in there, right?
There is
an explanation of why they exist in the first place, and I think it's actually very valid. Just so you know, like, the Vigors themselves were just being introduced now. However, I still think it was a missed opportunity not to use or have more enemies commonly using these Vigors, if they're supposed to be the elitist of the troops in this world of Columbia.
Yep, exactly. And I was talking on a Gamasutra post about this last night, and one of the elements, like, as you said, was really missed by Bioshock Infinite was making enemies that could basically stand toe-to-toe with the player, or fight fire with fire. If you look at a game like The Darkness 2, which obviously doesn't have the story or, you know, the art of Bioshock, but instead it had better enemy design, as the game went on, you would fight enemies who would use similar powers to you, or had the ability to weaken you. They knew that your character was weak against light, so they had enemies, you know, carrying handheld spotlights. And all this was designed to basically force you not to basically rely on one power or one tactic, but to change how you play the game when you got to these specific encounters.
Right, and I think that it did a pretty good job, but don't discredit Darkness 2. I think it had a great art style. It had an interesting enough story where it was playing with the concept of, is this all real or is this not? And, you know, because it is, if you look at, you break down Darkness 2 into what it is, you're a mob boss who, you know, runs this town and also has mystical powers, which is, you break it down, it's pretty ridiculous. So them playing off that concept of, maybe this is all in his head, I think that was a great gameplay, story device.
Mm-hmm.
However, Again, you talk about like enemies being difficult. I mean, that's true and not true, because at first half of the game, you're just fighting normal people, and it is pretty arcadey if you start playing. Because, yeah. I mean, they just shout random stuff, but they're so easy to take down.
Yeah, but as the Dark Souls did go on, by about maybe quarter to halfway, that's when you start seeing enemies, you start seeing them setting up spotlights to fight you, or you start fighting, you know, the guys with darkness shields of their own. And there's one part you start actually fighting enemies who could rip the guns out of your hands during a fight, which I thought was a very interesting take on that. And I was kind of expecting more from the enemies in Bioshock, as it never really, as, I mean, yes, they were challenging, but that was mainly because of the stat difference in terms of health and your lack of ammo.
Well, just going back to the darkness, by the way, the biggest flaw in that game is it ended less than, like, 6 hours or whatever. So as soon as we got to those enemies, the game was already over. Though people complain about the four-player campaign being, like, sucking away a single-player campaign, I still think the four-player campaign was actually pretty decent. I actually thought that the four-player campaign, the co-op campaign, was still engaging, and I thought it was pretty fun when we experimented with it. As for Bioshock, I think, again, talk about before, there's a missed opportunity where they could have given more people vigor abilities, right? Or, you know, they could also use the, you know, the chairs that you create, stuff like that. Why weren't there more mosquitoes, like those flying blimp machine guns coming after you on a more common basis? Because you're always in the sky. There would always be a danger. I think they should have played that up. Like, a lot of the things that you use against the enemies should be used against yourself, too.
Definitely.
And it's still there. I mean, there's firemen, right? And they're pretty nasty. When they throw, like, there's the radius of their explosion, they're huge. So, they're pretty nasty, but they're too rare, you know?
Yeah. And another point that I want to talk about in terms of narrative versus gameplay is I want to bring up The Walking Dead. Now, obviously, we both love The Walking Dead from last year by Telltale.
Mm-hmm.
And in that game, it was another game where the focus was obviously on the narrative. The gameplay was mainly to serve that narrative, but at the same time, it didn't feel like, I guess it's hard to explain, like the gameplay didn't exactly get in the way of the narrative, I think, of The Walking Dead. They did a pretty good job of how you play the game was corresponding to the story, even though there wasn't a lot of gameplay. And I think that is a better example of defining an experience. When I play The Walking Dead, I never complained about, you know, why couldn't I go here? Why couldn't I shoot these zombies? Because I was basically getting involved in that experience. But when I played Bioshock Infinite, the experience was basically having that trouble connecting between gameplay and narrative because of the problems as we talked about.
Well, you understand that Walking Dead is streamlined, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the whole, like, the puzzle solving itself was very, you know, easy. And when there was difficult puzzles in it, it was out of place, I would say. Because what happened is when you have a difficult puzzle, or a kind of medium puzzle, you know, there puts it like a halt on the flow, right? You're stopped. And then you get pulled out of the experience, because you want to keep it going. So most of the stuff was pretty intuitive, not archaic, like the fish plus his hook equals key kind of thing.
Yep. And
good.
Speaking about simplifying or streamlining, I think that's been a general complaint when I've been lurking around forums and message boards that the people who have complained about Bioshock Infinite, they use that same word. The game felt streamlined when you basically put it side to side by other first-person shooters, or even the ones that I brought up on my five-part series that just finished yesterday, that when you start putting it to these games that had a focus on gameplay, these games were stronger. Now, of course, the narrative was stronger in Bioshock Infinite, but it definitely just shows how much of a difference or focus these games had compared to each other.
Well, I have a little theory behind what happened with Bioshock Infinite. Originally, Ken Levine had discussion, because there was a lot of like outrage for the box cover of BioShock because it was just a guy looking down, and thought that, you know, many fans like didn't do justice to the game. It wasn't relevant. It was just very forgettable. But Ken Levine said, you know, it doesn't matter. We just need sales. We need to get out there, and this is what our focus group said that was appropriate. You know, and same thing goes with the gameplay, the hyper violence. You know, the very basic, easy to understand guns. You know, the same shotgun, pistol, like rifle setup is very similar to, you know, just regular run of the mill shooters, and that's the audience they're trying to pull in. I think they were trying to pull in that shooter group to expand and sell as many copies as possible. Yep. But in doing so, and looking at that group and focus grouping around shooter people or whatever, they took away from the narrative. Because you're right, look at A Walking Dead. You know, it barely had gameplay, but it was an immersive experience.
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, originally when they pitched BioShock Infinite with the 2010 gameplay trailer, it was a lot more interesting because
definitely
they had, you could sneak around. The concept was you could sneak around box. Like, there was an example where you saw a mailman who was just a regular Columbia citizen, and he was going to be executed by these rebellious Fox populi. So you had a choice. You could either stop the execution or just walk by. And that's what they should have done. They shouldn't have locked combat like that.
Definitely. I was actually going to bring that point up next. I was watching the other day the 2011, I think it was either a trailer or a gameplay demo, and there was a scene where Elizabeth would actually create a thundercloud in the sky above Booker, and you combine that with the shock jockey vigor to basically do the super lightning attack on an entire group of enemies. And I thought something like that, being able to combine both characters' abilities, would have help make the gameplay a lot stronger than what we ended up with her very limited interaction with Booker.
Well, I would say technical limitation is probably the answer on that one. The script, because that would have to be scripted, you know? I don't think it would be, you know, I mean, it's possible too. Like, I guess you could do that. Like, if you could make a tear, you could make a lightning cloud and puddle there, but that still seems a bit of a stretch. But, you know, again, we're just talking about gameplay stuff, so we're not really spoiling anything, but she can open up tears to different worlds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth, you're a character that comes along with you, which is, by the way, I really thought she was a great companion. Because an implicit game design choice that they made was to include her within the combat as someone that gives you, you know, health or ammo when you need it. But more than that, like, you're playing to get through the game, but you're also playing to see her reactions to the world, because she's been caged up for all her life. So every time I went to an event, I would go and look what she was doing. So this added another, like, you know, gameplay element to it, which was checking on Elizabeth. But she was never a bother to me, which was great.
Yeah. I really came off cold to Elizabeth, and like I said, I'm trying to not go too far into spoilers, but speaking in terms of gameplay, I felt that instead of making her be like an active participant or even just a part of Booker, she was more of an exposition device and I think someone described her on the forum as basically health dispenser.
I wouldn't say that. Like, again, so exposition device? No, I don't think so. She was used as a device eventually for some moments, but that wasn't her role in the game itself. She was a lot more. She was the tether between all things. She's a very important character to Booker, and Booker is important to her. And their mission is equally important, which is to get her to, or, you know, off Columbia. But I still think that she worked very well as a gameplay device and a narrative device. These people that complain about exposition is probably talking about, you know, the ending, which I'm going to go into.
I'll give you an example of where Elizabeth sort of broke the experience for me.
Was it the lockpicking?
No, this was actually during combat.
Okay.
As everyone knows, Elizabeth provides you with health, ammo, salts, which are the vigor resource during combat. And during while I was playing the game, she popped up with the prompt saying, press button to get ammo. Well, I was busy killing an enemy, and so I missed it by literally half a second, and she stopped basically giving me ammo for the entire fight. And that irked me, because it was like, you found me a gun, but because I didn't respond within, 2 seconds, the gun magically disappeared.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Because, like, when that happens to me, all I do is back up onto cover, and then she automatically gives it to me. That's pretty much it. If I'm still firing, she won't do anything. But then you had a lot more odder glitches than I did. I didn't have any. You had a ton, it seems.
Yeah. And this was, I think, during 1999 mode, but then I also had that case happen just in playing on hard mode. And that actually is a good point I just want to ask you about. As we talk about with the experience, do you think having difficulty levels hurts, like, the overall experience of the game, or do you think it adds to it?
To be honest with you, I think that this game benefits from the different difficulty modes, just because their version of normal is so easy. Why is there even shooting involved in this game? People should just fall over. So I think that's a good thing, but again, I think it's more of a something from the past, coming to the future. Something that we dragged along from the arcade eras. Not the arcade era, but the,
the older console.
Yeah, exactly. Era. To, superficially extend play. Right? But I think the narrative itself engages you to replay the game. And I think that's awesome that they've done that.
Now, I think for me, I think the problem with difficulty levels for a game like Bioshock Infinite is that they're so wildly different from each other that it sort of hurts, when you're talking about the game as to what's considered the proper way of playing it. Because if you play Bioshock Infinite on easy or normal, as you just said, the gameplay is pretty much non-existent. You can just stand in front of these guys and you're not going to die. But then the second you switch to hard, all of a sudden, the game mechanics become that much more prominent because of the stat tweaking that was done.
What's even the point of shields in hard mode? They just go away immediately.
Yeah.
But the thing is, with hard mode, at least you have to use the skylines more. It's like, if you're playing easy or normal or whatever, you're pretty much a tank. You're a tank in human form. Nothing can hurt you.
Yeah.
But in hard, you're going to have to use the skylines to get away from some horrific danger. And I think, that's one thing I want to bring up. I think a bright spot for the game is skylines.
Yeah.
Because for me, it allowed me to fight with my own pace, right? Because with normal shooters, it's all about, and just in real life too, it's all about cover and shooting back. That's it. So if you play the game boring, you would just hit find cover, wait till your opportunity, and then shoot, and then move on to the next cover. That's it. However, the skyline, it gave you a sense of speed. You could control the fight a lot better.
Yeah.
It was chaotic, but it definitely broke the monotony. I think that was a great success, and that to me is what makes it a little bit better than a generic shooter, And the skyline can do a lot of cool things too. Not only can you jump from any point and hit enemies and knock them off into the clouds, you could also become, there's also perks like being invulnerable or lighting the whole ground on fire or doing automatic execution or hitting them and getting hypnosis on them, Or what's it called? What's the vigor called?
Possession.
Possession, right.
Yeah.
Again. So I think that was a really great improvement. However, there wasn't enough of the skyline. That's my big thing. They should have, just like with the Vigors, there's a missed opportunity, right? They should have used the skylines more, as much as they could, I think. Because again, sometimes you forget you're in a floating city. But when you're on the skyline, you realize, oh my god, I'm 2,000 miles above the ground or whatever. So I think that skyline was probably something that made it unique. But again, you could just play just straight up cover shoot, and that's super lames.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And getting back to the idea of narrative, I want to talk about another game that handled narrative in the complete opposite direction of Bioshock Infinite, Dark Souls. Now, you haven't played Dark Souls yet, right?
No. I don't. For some reason, I don't really feel like I want to play it.
It's one of those games that it's sort of like, do I really want to play this? But the difference between the two is that Dark Souls has a very deep story. There is a lot there about the world, the player situation, and just what's happening. And it's similar to Bioshock, isn't it, that this setting is, you know, try to be explained. But where Bioshock Infinite, you know, I guess, let's say, I'm not sure I would say the word, like, dumps the information, but it shows it to you, you know, it basically puts it right in your face a lot of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Dark Souls basically hides everything. Every item that you find in the game basically has, like, about four paragraphs of lore relating to it.
Okay, stop. That's what I hate. I hate that. That's an exposition dump right there. And that's a lot of Japanese games. I hate that. It's just, you want to know more about this world? Read a book. I'm like, no, I don't want this. I want it to be told to me through gameplay, told through me with subtlety. That's a big thing. And no, I think Bioshock did a good job with that, because again, when games tell heavy themes like racism, nationalism, religion, they do it really heavy-handedly, like with a big heavy hand, and they say, like, this is the correct viewpoint, because all games, in a way, are biased to a degree. That's just something that's in every medium. So what they did was they just put you in a world and let you kind of engage. It's like, this is how it is. So this is how you engage. So you get both sides of the issue. In fact, there is a turning point in the game where you see both sides of an argument. I think that's really cool. And it's subtle, too. I just think that, again, the hyper-violence ruined it. If you were just allowed to experience this world more in depth and had a choice to not fight, because, again, you know, he's not a soldier. He was a soldier, but now he's more of a roguish type, kind of. And, you know, they don't always go for a fight because they know they can't always win.
Yeah.
So I think that is such a big disconnect. It's not, to me, not the gameplay as much as just the gunplay, just the violence. It just didn't feel like it fit. Like, why did people so... I mean, they're hired, and they... I guess what I'm saying is, because it does feel, like, tacked on, I feel like it's an exploitation, and I think that the game didn't need it.
I was also really surprised with just when you shot someone in the head in the game, it wasn't like you shot them in the head and they fell dead. You shot them in the head literally exploded. Even with, like, a regular pistol. I thought that just seemed really odd to me.
Arcane.
I mean, when I played, like, Bulletstorm, which is obviously a hyper-violent game, that, when you shot someone, like, in the head with, like, a regular gun, it didn't, you know, blow up into, like, a blood pinata. Unless, you know, you're using, like, a rocket launcher or some explosive weapon. So it kind of just seemed very weird to me just how ultra-violent Infinite got. And don't forget about, you know, the melee execution animations.
Yeah.
That stuff is just like, that's like right out of Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, and the thing is that people complained about the enemies being like so, you know, not caring about their own lives and running in to get killed by Booker. And that's appropriate in Bioshock 1, where there are splicers. They were barely human, you know? They were pretty much monsters.
Yeah.
And they're just getting their next fix. That made plenty of sense, and that was a good connection between narrative and gameplay. Here, it's a lot less clear, but my argument of why they were attacking you in such high frequency is because the main antagonist, Comstock, who is the creator of this world of Columbia, he, you know, knew when Booker was going to come. So he put things like the sign saying AD, which is, you know, on the side of his hand. Actually on the back of his hand. And it says that if anyone sees a guy with an AD on the back of his hand, he is the false prophet, or he is the false shepherd. That's the real term, false shepherd. And, you know, you need to kill him immediately. So that makes plenty of sense, because these people aren't attacking you because they're spliced up, but through religious zealousy, honestly.
Yeah. Now, I actually have to call bullcrap on that for one very important reason. You see, like, early in the game, you see the poster with the warning of AD before Booker actually fights enemies, and it just kind of seems like, wouldn't it, like, take you a second to realize, these guys don't like people with AD on their hands. Maybe I should just, you know, put some gloves on. Like, don't you think that would have just, like, solved, like, 90% of the fights in BioShock Infinite?
Well, I think what happened was he was ID'd, and from there, they just, people, like, because there was a scene later when you're in a house, and people are describing what Brooker looked like, right? And plus, I played through it twice, and I never attacked those people for some reason. I just didn't feel like it was appropriate, because they're just, like, just some lady describing what I look like. I'm like, okay. But again, you know, they've already ID'd you, you know, it's already too late. What, as soon as, like in stealth games, as soon as you're on stealth, you're done. It's game over. And the only way, you know, you slip away is because they can't find you, or, you know, they forgot about you to a degree. Mm-hmm. But, you know, their posters are still there. People, as soon as they see you, they know.
Now, I think it is a bit of a shame that neither of us have actually played Dishonored yet. Because when I was talking to people on Kama Sutra, they brought up Dishonored as sort of like the anti-BioShock, a game where narrative and gameplay actually clicked really well. But unfortunately, I haven't played the game yet, neither have you, so we really can't get into that.
I heard it suffered from the same thing with Darkness 2. Really short campaign. Like, really short campaign. And there was, watching reviews and stuff, there was a disconnect between narrative and play. The gameplay itself was really stellar. Like, it kind of went for people that liked to get right in the face of, you know, their enemies, or people like me who like to be stealthy and just like to crouch everywhere. So it was cool. So it's a lot of player choice and experimentation. That's what we want. You know, we want to not only experience something, but engage with the experience. And that's what it's doing. As for, you know, the disconnect in the narrative, even though it has a kind of, at least from what I've seen, a cool concept, the concept that, you know, there's a steampunk like city based around whale oil. And there's like this weird being called the Other, who, you know, he pretty much like ruined, he's pretty much the devil in that world, and he's the guy you're kind of working for. So I mean, that's, it's all, it's all cool and all, but the NPCs and the people you interact with, they are pretty weak from what I've seen in the videos I've seen, a couple of gameplay stuff. And there's a disconnect because you become like, you know, a hired hitman instead of a man out for vengeance. It's different. A different kind of thing. And that's a problem. As for BioShock Infinite, it's not the characters that speak that are the problem. It's the surrounding NPCs that's the problem. The first part of the game, first 20 minutes of BioShock Infinite, it's about immersion, right? Getting you in, getting you at least exposed to this floating city, this floating world. It's really cool, right? And you see some of the cracked stuff in there, with sometimes, like, people say some pretty nasty things. But in 1912, you know, it's very, very common, right? They did their research. And the thing is that a lot of the NPCs had the same face, and that really irritated me. Because, you know, you spent all this money on this game. Can't you vary it up a little more than just, you know, four male faces, three female faces? So that definitely pulled me out of it. I mean, some people argued that, especially in the baptism, the first baptism, in the very first, it's whatever, it's like a forced thing. You need to do a baptism before you get into the city of Columbia. All the people had the same face and hair, but that argument was that they're all very Aryan, if you know what I mean. Blonde hair, blue eyed.
Yeah.
But as you get in the city, it's, I mean, that gets thrown out the window because it's just laziness from that point on. Because I saw a guy shoe shining another guy with the same face. I'm like, oh, it's weird. But yeah. But again, I mean, there's some things that BioShock does so right in terms of immersion, and some things that just pull me out of it. And that's the depressing part of it.
Yeah. I think going back to what you were talking about with Dishonored, with the gameplay, another element that I was hearing some people complain about with how modern games have sort of diluted the experience is how they give you a lot of cool toys, but they make it so the only way you can really use them is if you mess up. And one of the examples that someone brought up was Batman Arkham Asylum, or Arkham City, where if you basically play the game stealthily, you can take out most of the enemies without even getting into a giant fight or even using most of the gadgets. And the only times that you can really get fancy is, you know, if you mess up and you get spotted. And I think that is somewhat of a good point in how games have become somewhat diluted and how they don't really reward expert players. They reward more or less the average or moderate players.
Well, again, if there's difficulty is too high, you know, you're going to get a very niche crowd. It's business. In the end of the day, it's a business. They need to sell it. And it needs to be playable to the average person. That's sad, but it's also true. Because some people don't have such a high tolerance as we do. But talking about stealth, and, you know, the skills needed for stealth play. I'm a big player of stealth games, and I love the new Deus Ex, and I think they did it very well, the balance of stealth. However, just like any other game, they had a huge disconnect where the boss battles were lethal only. Ridiculous, right?
Definitely.
But that was fixed with the Wii U version, which is sad because it's never coming for the PC, which all the players are. All the people that love the game are on consoles, all the other consoles and in the PC, so it makes no sense to me that they did that. But again, so the boss battles in Deus Ex were lethal. And that was because of, you know, it was farmed out to a third party. They just never played Deus Ex before, which is incredibly silly to me. Because you make such a beautiful shine to this world. It has this great aesthetic. It has its gameplay that rewards skill and experimentation, similar to Dishonored. But you drop the ball with that. And just like Bioshock did, just things like that pulled me out, right?
Mm-hmm. And with that Deus Ex example, I think it's obvious that they were trying to appeal to, you know, like the regular first-person shooter crowd. So they wanted to make, you know, like a regular bullet shield boss fight type thing. Just hit the guy until you drain his health.
Well, there was a system in the game called Typhoon. And when you used it, you spin around in circles and blow up everything around you, doing like massive damage. First of all, the first boss fight, I just got the rocket launcher with me, just in case. Just let that take up all my room, just because I knew that boss was coming. The second time, I just used Typhoon. Like, there was an enemy where she could turn invisible, right? So you can't see her. All you can do is you have to look at the ground and see where she steps, right?
Mm-hmm.
Use two Typhoons, she's dead. Done. Boss battle over. So if you're going to make crappy boss battles, at least test all the mechanics first. So, I don't know, like, but boss battles themselves are something we should talk about in depth later for another cast. Because we have to. There's a lot of great games that just have terrible boss battles or don't understand what a boss battle should be, which is, you know, using what you know to your advantage, you know? Using the skills that you've accumulated over the course of the game.
I won't go back to a point we were talking about earlier with how, when we talk about difficulty levels and how they are a byproduct from older consoles. Now, obviously, storytelling, narrative are relatively new elements of the video game industry. We really didn't start to see cinematic quality games until PlayStation 1, maybe even arguably PlayStation 2 era. That's sort of when the graphics is caught up to the storytelling. Now, in your opinion, do you think older games, I'm talking 1996 and before, do you think these games were able to had really good experiences? And if so, why?
You mean as terms of an immersion kind of thing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, for sure. In fact, I think the whole Japanese game market was a lot better because they were limited. They were limited to the technology they had. So they had to focus on gameplay to tell the narrative. And that's a great thing, because you look at Japanese games today, and a lot of them are like Hideo Kojima, kind of like tons of exposition, tons of cutscenes. To me, Japanese modern games equal, especially, I'm talking about the AAAs, not the smaller companies. The AAAs, the ones that got released to the Western, is pretty much just cutscene generators.
So, like, are you saying, like, Resident Evil, Square Enix, those types of games?
Yeah. I mean, the most recent Resident Evils are, you know, pretty much just cutscene generators. And they're just so way off the mark. It just upsets me. And, like, a lot of people think it's cool to play with the concept of exploitation, you know, exploitation of violence, exploitation of women, etc., etc. They think, in Japan, at least what I've seen, they think it's really cool, but all it is lazy writing. That's what it is.
There's definitely like a fine line. Like this is what I talk about in the Bulletstorm. There's a fine line between making something that is a satire of it and something that is satire and something that is just, you know, doing the same exact thing that you were trying to make fun of. And that's where, like, with Bulletstorm, like, they were trying to make fun of, you know, the bro culture, you know, over testosterone type meathead type gameplay.
Right.
But for a lot of people, it was, instead of it being a satire, it basically was one of the prime examples. And even you said that because you were like, why are you playing this game when I loaded it up?
It's the same reason why I would ask you why you play Duke Nukem. Because Duke Nukem is the same thing. They think they're being clever, right? But they think they're making things like the Master Chief's helmet, references. But they think that they're making a satire, but that's not what a satire is. That's the references. That's all it is. It's like, look how clever we are. Incorrect. So, I mean, some people just don't get it. And the thing is that with Japanese games, especially the bigger games, they're trying to, again, emulate more like Hollywood cinematics. And sometimes they have great cinematography, but most times, as soon as any character opens their mouths, it's just lame all over.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I want to talk about one really good example. As you were talking about, like, a lot of the smaller Japanese developers have been doing really great games.
Right.
One really great example of narrative and gameplay, I think, would be Persona 4. Did you play Persona 4?
Oh, I have not. I have seen part of the anime, and I have the soundtrack, but I haven't played the game because I don't have a PS3 or PS2.
Or PS2 or Vita.
Or a Vita, yeah. No one has a Vita. Except for one. I only know one person with a Vita, and for some reason he waited in line for it.
The only one that I know was Jason from Horde 3.
Well, I think he has to have it.
So getting back to Persona 4, one thing they do with the narrative is the concept of peer pressure or self-identity. People who are basically struggling with what they really are on the inside and what they're pretending to be on the outside. And it's one of the few games that actually explore the concept of transgender or gay characters. And this actually becomes an important part of the narrative, as you basically have to explore this person's over-the-top version of themselves. So, and it was just a very interesting game, and I know there's been articles about it, but I was surprised that we didn't see more talk about how well Persona 4, for such like an outrageous and just crazy plot, talked about, you know, regular issues of everyday life, and how that fit into this narrative of having to basically battle your own demons.
Well, again, it wasn't marketed for like a mass market, especially an American market. And you know, the audience between here and Japan is a lot different. But you're right. I think they definitely took a leap, and they just tried the experiment. And I think it's one of the first times they ever talked about the concept of transgenders. And they handled homosexuality in a mature light, right? Because it was Bulletstorm, they make gay jokes all the time. They talk about butts the whole time, and they think that's funny. But, you know, that's not how it should be demonstrated. I think my first experience with a gay character within a game is actually Longest Journey.
Mm-hmm.
The landlord was gay, but she wasn't in my face. First of all, she was the first lesbian. There's another one, too. But she wasn't in my face about it. She just mentioned it, you know? She just talked about her and her life with a partner. And that was pretty engaging. And, you know, you know, she's kind of like motherly. And I think that was really cool. And the voice acting was really well done, even to this day. The voice acting is very good. But I think that's the best way to portray, you know, those kind of classes, minorities, whatever. They're just people in a situation. That's what they are. They're not, you shouldn't, you know, put them on overdrive, because then they become a caricature of what a person should be. Like, if we talk about Walking Dead again, Lee, you're playing a black character, but being black doesn't encompass who he is, right?
Doesn't define him, basically.
Exactly. I mean, there's some things here and there, a couple character interactions where you kind of see, like, they perceive him differently.
Yeah.
But in the end of the day, you know, he's like, I'm black. But it doesn't matter. This is the situation at hand.
Yeah. And I'm probably going to repeat this for our sexism talk, but it's the same thing with female characters. Creating a good female character isn't about making a female character. It's about making a good character in general. And not, you know, placing it on a pedestal saying, hey, look at this, it's a woman. Hey, look at this.
Well, yeah, you know, a lot of people, like, and this has to be, you have to be careful with this, but a lot of people that write good female characters just write good characters, or they write the characters as if they're male, to a degree. And the reason I talk about the male thing is, and it, by the way, if you go too far, then it's bad, because obviously then it's just unisex. But Elaine Bennis from Seinfeld, I was just watching the behind the scenes on that, and she was actually written into the show as, just like, right, as a male character. But because of the actress's delivery, understanding, you know, a lot of stuff was conveyed appropriately to being a woman, too. So it's kind of like double filtered. You know, first you write it as a male or no gender, and then the actress then filters it with her own perspective of gender. I think that's a pretty cool thing. So voice actors and stuff probably should engage it that way. And at some point they do. I think there is less, like with a show like Seinfeld, there's a little more fluidity, because with games, you have to, as soon as you change anything, you can't take a million takes because, you know, you have to, like, lip sync and you have to do the animations on the eyes and everything. It's not until those things become, you know, more fluid, easier in terms of the workflow. We want to have that kind of fluidity as in, like, shows, movies, etc., different takes.
And I just want to bring up one quick point for that, and then I want to go back to talking about the experience concept. One of the things I heard about the Mass Effect series was how well they define the female version of Shepard, or
Femme Shepard. Way better. Way better than regular Shepard. Regular Shepard is just the most boring guy on the planet. And if you pick all the evil options, he's just a dick. So, Femme Shep is one I always played, and it's really cool, because in Mass Effect 3, the box, you could flip it over, and it was Femme Shep. I'm like, aw, yeah.
And I think part of that also had to do with the voice actress. She was voiced by, voice actress extraordinaire Jennifer Hale, who she's, like, one of, like, the three big voice actresses, I think, both in, you know, comic, cartoons, video games, you name it. She's that recognizable of a voice.
Who's the person that does Cortana's voice? Because she also has a lot of famous voice actor work, too.
I know it's not Tara Strong.
Or she doesn't really do games as much. Well, she does. She did a couple Japanese games, too.
Yeah, she's also did a lot of the voices in the new Injustice game.
Oh, makes sense. Because she did a lot of... She did Teen Titans. She was Raven.
Mm-hmm. Let me see. I don't know her voice off the top of my head. I can do a quick look.
While you're looking for that, again, so talking about voice actresses and talking about the concept of scripts, I wonder how much, you know, free reign they actually have, you know? Mm-hmm. How much, I think we always overlook direction when it comes to games because we don't see it. And I think, you know, I think game directors should get more credit because they're put up with so much more. Just not so much more, but such a different type of experience than a regular movie director does.
Yeah. Okay, I found the person. Cortana was voiced by Jen Taylor.
Okay.
And she was also the voice of Zoe in Left 4 Dead 1 and 2.
Yes, I loved Zoe. Yeah, but yeah, she's in so many games. Just playing random characters. And she definitely has a distinctive voice, too.
Yeah. All right. Going back to our talk about experience, one of the elements that we got on the subject of for our chat was on, you know, how different people basically prioritize different elements of the experience. And the part of this conversation was I was complaining about how so many people gave BioShock Infinite a 10 out of 10 despite the problem. And your argument was that these were people who focus somewhat similar to you on the story, on the experience, as opposed to the gameplay. And I think that's very interesting in the sense, as we talk about, in this whole idea of gameplay, narrative experience, how experience is a very loosely defined term.
Definitely. It's a game, or any medium, is subjective. And, probably with your logic, a 10 out of 10 can never be accomplished, because 10 out of 10 is perfect. But nothing's perfect. So it has to be top score of 9.9 or something. So the scales kind of will be skewed forever because of your logic. But I say it's their right. If they feel that they experience something truly engaging, something unique, something with a lot of quality to it, they can give it a high rank, you know? Most, to be honest with you, a lot, most people don't even vote in twos and threes and stuff. They just vote ones to fives, like the average person. If you look at a game and look at the user reviews, it's either fives or ones. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way, so go ahead.
My argument, though, is that if the reviewer basically ignores issues, like if you look at all the reviews for BioShock Infinite, there is no mention of issues of the gameplay, of like the general lack of like how the shooting felt off, and that's where I sort of take offense. I mean, I can say the game is 10 out of 10 if the gameplay was great, even if there were issues. If the gameplay as a whole stood, you know, was good enough that it basically stood apart from it, I could see giving it a 10 out of 10. But if there's issues, actual qualitative issues with the game design, I don't think a game should get a 10 out of 10 for that.
I think they have the right to do it, just because the game, you're talking about like the gameplay itself being broken. It's not. But it's not great. It's not stellar. It doesn't match up to the narrative. The narrative is extremely strong, very unique. And again, it brings in more philosophy, which is sorely lacking a lot of writing with games. But with that said, I understand where you're coming from, but I'm saying here we're having a game with a stellar narrative and experience in medium gameplay. But to me, it was still engaging, it was still fun, and it was challenging. At least if it wasn't playing it easy. So I think that, you know, you're discrediting a very quality game over some discrepancies of taste.
Now, here's my question for you then. Not counting BioShock Infinite, if you were to rate a game out 10 out of 10, what would be an example of a 10 out of 10 game that you played that wasn't BioShock Infinite?
Dragon Force for the Sega Saturn. Why? Because I would vote on that game not only for gameplay and aesthetics, because even now, I mean, they look kind of dated now to a degree, but they're still interesting look. But the replayability of it was really high. And I had different perspective of views, because you could pick different... Let me just explain what Dragon Force is. So Dragon Force is a game where you have a giant continent with different sections for different rulers. And each of them represent, like, different, like, tribes, in a way. Like, there's elves, there's, like, beastmen, there's just samurais, there's regular soldiers, etc., etc. All with different styles, but they all have intertwining stories. So, with Dragon Force. So, that was a really cool thing, because that increased replayability. And BioShock itself had implicit replayability by the narrative alone. That was a really cool thing to have. And some people say they can play it once and it's enough, but playing it through a second time, you see the world through, you know, different eyes, because you know the whole story to a degree. And it's just like any game, you pick up more and more and more of the story and lore. But it's not thrown at you, it's not given to you in like blobs of text. I mean, we do have voxophones, but you can listen to it at your own discretion. And it's a lot easier to listen to something than to read something. It sounds like really barbaric for me to say that, but it's true. That's why audiobooks are so on the rise over just regular book sales.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess for me, if I were to say some games would be 10 out of 10 in my view, I would say Demon's Souls, I think, would have been 10 out of 10 for me. It was just such an amazing experience. Gameplay that, at that time, it was just never heard of a game to be that challenging and that rewarding to play. Another example, I think, would be The Binding of Isaac.
I was going to say that too. Binding of Isaac, Binding of Isaac and FTL. I was thinking about that as my other solutions.
Yeah, I mean, The Binding of Isaac, I mean, it's a simple game, but he did so much to... He basically worked the roguelike elements and the progression system so perfectly into that game that it just made the game just elevate to such a high level. And of course, let's talk about, there's always the weird story. I mean, this was, you know, Edmund McMillan's, you know, standard, you know, very disturbing storyline, but it just worked how everything came together. And of course, FTL, I think that's another good example. I wouldn't say FTL would be a 10 out of 10, because I kind of felt that the replayability sort of lessened, but I would say that would be a close one, like 9.5, 9.8 really game. Because as you said, the gameplay on that is just so different. I mean, have you ever played a game like FTL before?
Board game like it, but yeah. Again, Binding of Isaac, that had a great art style to it. That made it very unique too. I think that if it was just, you know, again, if it was different, in terms of like more basic shapes and whatever, more generic, I think it wouldn't lack, that 10 out of 10 would suffer, I would say. Just because a lot of the gameplay is tied to the design itself of, because you're kind of, you have a narrative every time you play a game, right? Every time you play it, it's a different story in your head because it's roguelike. But a lot of the enemies, a lot of the things that you can blow up and attack, that, you know, the poop and stuff, they're all different parts of his mind, to a degree. And you can kind of see where he's coming from, because he's come from a world of abuse. Just so you guys know, The Binding of Isaac, the story behind that, is that there's this character who lives with this mom. The character's name is obviously Isaac, and he lives with this mom. And she's very religious. And one day, a voice from above tells her that she needs to kill Isaac to appease the god. So, you know, Isaac goes, runs and hides, and ends up in a labyrinth. And that's the basics of the story. But, you know, this could all be in his head or whatever. But a lot of the stuff is really gory. Really, really disturbing. But if you look at the elements separately and put it with the narrative, along with the gameplay, you're going to find that it's telling a story in a very unconventional way. And I think it's really cool.
Yeah. And I would say my last example, this is a game that I think had some issues, but I think ultimately the gameplay won over, was Xenoblade Chronicles for the Wii.
Oh, I still need to play that.
Yeah. What I loved about the game was it really felt like the designers took a long look at JRPG design and said, okay, these are the problems with it, let's get those out there, and let's make something better. Well, and as a design, it just worked so well. It had like the same kind of, I guess, like a single player MMO quality to it that like Final Fantasy 13 had. Yeah, no, wait, Final Fantasy 12.
12.
Right. Or, yeah, 12. That one. And they did a lot, like, you don't have to turn in most of the quests. You can just, they'll automatically turn in and give you the reward right there. So, technically, I mean, the narrative and the world sort of didn't quite mesh because of that, but I think overall the game was stronger for it. Now, there were some issues with the gameplay. It got a little bit tedious towards the end of the game, and some of the side quests could have been explained better, but I think ultimately the positives outweighed the negatives. And I think I spent 110 hours playing the game.
Wow.
That was my number one game of 2012. So that was definitely just a great game to play. But that would, to me, would be like a 10 out of 10. A game that the gameplay was so amazing that it just felt like, I'm trying to think of an example, like trying to think of like an analogy. I would say sort of like someone, like a gymnast, like doing like a competition performing, you know, like every part of their routine perfectly. Now, there may have been like a hiccup here and there, but ultimately, what they did won out over any little missteps they had.
Well, the thing is that, hey, that same thing goes with a lot of reviewers with Bioshock. You know, they were able to look past certain flaws because the experience was so great. And it's funny that you mentioned Xenoblade and Dark Souls. Both of them are pretty much Western RPGs made in Japan, you know, because that's pretty much what they are. They're out of the norm.
Mm-hmm. And Xenoblade Chronicles, as a little fun fact, as we all know, Nintendo at the time refused to translate it over, even though, as you said, it was more aimed for Western audiences. And it took, you know, petitions and just about like every major game site screwing Nintendo for them to go, okay, we'll pour it over, I guess.
I think the biggest flaw in Xenoblade, the game, from what I've seen, it's pretty much just being on the Wii. I think that's the biggest problem.
Yeah.
It just looks so old. It looks super dated.
Now, supposedly you can play on the PC. There are Wii emulators, which I'm, of course, not saying you should or you shouldn't
do. Oh, yeah, there is one. And someone said you could up-res it and stuff. I'm like, wow, it's pretty cool. Someone had made a texture pack for it, too. I'll try it out.
Now, with Demon's Souls, I think, as you said, it succeeded a lot better because it was on a popular system. Now, I was trying to remember, I'm pretty sure with Demon's Souls that they switched publishers. I think the original publisher was Atlas because I think no one else wanted to take the chance. And then From Software switched to Namco Bandai for Dark Souls 1 and 2.
Well, yeah. I think that they had lightning in a bottle there, you know? And, you know, they took that chance, at least Atlas did, and they showed how successful this could be. And hopefully more games will go in that direction. The concept of player skill versus average skill, which we talked about earlier in the cast.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And again, like, the reason we love those old arcade games is because of that challenge. I mean, they were meant to eat your quarters, but it was still something that you had to have a certain skill. You had to earn the skill to be able to get to the goal at the end of the game. Because I was playing Ghosts and Goblins the other night, and like, my god, that game is relentless. Relentless in terms of what you need to do and what you need to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So
now, that is a good point about how what is considered the norm has changed so much over the years. Like, if you look, I mean, it's pretty much a fact that games from late 80s to early 90s were harder than what we see today. A game aimed at a child in 1990 is, you know, will probably be like a game more for adults today.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's because they want to... Our goal in the end of the day is to grow, you know, it's pretty much gamers in general. We need... The more people play games, the bigger audience, the more profits you get. And if you make games that are simpler, easier, and, like, you know, more casual to get into, you know, you have more chance of converting a casual into a hardcore gamer, and they'll have a higher attachment rates with your systems to game. So I think it's important for them to do that to a degree, but there's so much time where they sacrifice gameplay or experience for marketing
and definitely.
The casual experience. Look at SimCity. That game never needed to be multiplayer or social or any of that crap. None of it.
Yep.
Small plot of land? No.
I think another reason about why games back then were harder was that the market was, of course, very small. Video game acceptance really didn't happen until, I would say, late 90s, early 2000s. I think that was like the watershed moment, really, for mainstream acceptance, because I think that was like the first really big game that everyone knew about. But if we look at, you know, 1989, and, you know, the NES and Genesis era, most of the people playing video games at the time were, you know, either older gamers or people who had higher skill levels, like, because of such a niche audience, they were trying to appeal to them by making the games harder. I mean, who can forget, you know, like the whole Star Wars series of games?
Uh-huh.
Those are, you know,
Star Wars?
Yeah, the whole thing. There's Star Wars for the NES, the Super Star Wars series. Those games are just, you know, freaking hard for the time.
Well, I would say it's not really as much as playing to the niche, but I would say that it came, again, they were evolving from arcades to home consoles.
Mm-hmm.
So the extreme difficulty and slim chance of success was brought over from the arcade games to console, because a lot of times they were just straight ports, right? Or actually, not straight, they were like lower ports, because they weren't as... Did have the fidelity as most of the arcade games do, but yeah, I mean, that's where it really comes from.
All right, here's my next question for you. as we talked about earlier, with how games have become more cinematic, trying to delve into that level of the experience, what's your opinion on, like, David Cage and his games? You know, Fahrenheit, Heavy Rain, which are predominantly on the cinematic side. They're less about the gameplay and just more about trying to tell the story or show the story from different angles.
Well, I actually really liked Indigo Prophecy, like the concept behind it. I remember when I first heard about the game, they're all like, you play a killer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also play the detectives that are chasing him. So I thought that was pretty cool. Because, like, example, if you were to not, like, in the first scene, you murder a guy, right? You can't control yourself, you murder somebody. And you have the chance to clean up after yourself. And if you don't, you know, the officers will come in, they'll say something different. They're like, well, we got a messy killer, you know? That doesn't care, it's the crime of passion. They say different things. I think that was really cool. But a mechanic that I... and people really hate on the Simon Says mechanic in that game. But I really liked... I think the most engaging gameplay was the dialogue choices. You had to make them very quickly. Mm-hmm. I think that was really cool. I haven't really seen a game like that before that. That was like the big thing I took away from that game.
Yeah, and I really like that in Alpha Protocol as well, when they, or even The Walking Dead, when they challenge you that you can't spend, you know, 10 minutes thinking about a choice. You have only 10 seconds. And there were times where you kind of like stop for a second, you're trying to, you know, put these two different thoughts, you know, try to figure them out before time runs out. I thought that was just really interesting.
Well, yeah. I mean, I really liked Alpha Protocol. I thought it's probably right up there with Deus Ex. Like, it was a very quality game with a ton of bugs.
Yeah.
But your choices really did matter. It really did change up a lot. When you made a mistake, it followed through. But with Deus Ex, they also had problems with boss battles. What's the deal with that? But yeah, there was a character where you couldn't stealth around, and you had to, like shoot him with shotguns. But
and, like, pistols, I think, were just, like, incredibly broken in that game. So you get, like, slowed down, and then, you know, super fast shot, and you just, like, shoot the guy, like, 20 times in the head before time runs out.
Listen, the secret to the game is put every point in stealth and insta-kills and just go around invisible killing people. That's the way to do it. Just chain it together. But, yeah, that game had its faults, but its ambitions is what I applauded for. Same thing with Bioshock. Its ambitions is what I applauded for. And I think at some point it really hit its marks, similar to Alpha Protocol. It hit its marks also. It just, that one had, to me, actually a bigger disconnect, because that one boss battle where I had to run around in circles with a shotgun, you know what I'm talking about, right? The guy with the knives?
Yeah, was that like in like the guy's like dance studio or something?
Yeah, it was like a movie studio or something, yeah. It was terrible. It was like a club or something. And you were stuck, you couldn't escape. And he would run around with you knives. He would just, and all you had was shotguns. And, you know, and you had to shoot him from a distance with a shotgun, which is a situational weapon. And it's not meant to be shot at a long distance. So, it was an awful experience. And it ruined the entire flow of the game. It made no sense. That's similar to those boss battles, too. But, yeah. That was my problem.
I think another good example of where gameplay and narrative really lent itself well was Alan Wake.
Oh, yes. I think that was... people really hated the concept of the narration, but I think that it played well with the theme they were going for.
Yeah, and I think it was just a great twist when you realize where all the tropes and, you know, all, like, the problems with the writing came from when you figure out at the end, which I don't want to spoil it here. But you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes, of course. Me and Anna love that game.
Yeah. So, and I think that was a good example of how narrative and gameplay came together. It was a horror story, and it just did a good job of making you this one character who would basically be put in these situations where you really couldn't fight yourself out of it like in a traditional first-person shooter. You actually had to play it smart. You had to try to... get characters to follow you and try to take them down, because if you were surrounded that game, you were dead. And I think I just love how you actually had stamina. You couldn't just, you know, hold down the run button and avoid everything. It was just like a great horror feeling where, you know, you're running, you're almost there, but then your stamina runs out, so you're like limping to the spotlight to try to get into safety.
Throw flares, run. Throw flares, run. That's all I did. I was like, oh god, flare. But I love that game. And just, if anyone's had to play it, it's pretty much the real spiritual successor to Max Payne. If you love that writing and pacing, you'll love Alan Wake. Max Payne 3, nothing. It really brought, the only thing they brought over was the theme and the voice actor. But the rest of it did not match. Neo-noir did not match Max Payne.
Now, what do you think about open world games and how they generate experience? Like, like with Red Dead Revolution, I thought that was one, I think that was arguably my favorite
Revolution
game.
Revolution or Redemption?
Redemption, the second one, I'm saying.
I think it's Red Dead Revolver, the first one. And that was like a Japanese-y kind of game.
Yeah, and then the second one, I think that was Revolution, or let's go to Wikipedia.
I'm pretty sure it's Revolver and then Redemption.
No, yeah, Redemption.
Other one you're thinking about is Gun, which is interesting too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I think open world games, I think, are very tricky with providing experience because instead of it just being about story or narrative and gameplay, there's narrative, gameplay, and the world. And I think a lot of open world games kind of struggle with that. Like, if you look at a game like Saints Row the Third, it was a great game for gameplay. The narrative was just absolutely insane, but the world itself kind of felt a bit soulless to me in that regard.
Well, yeah, I agree to it. I think it was pretty fancy, though. And they had a lot of cultural enemies, right? You knew what area you were in when you were getting attacked by high-tech ninjas and stuff. Mm-hmm. And or Lucha Libre, whatever. But I thought it was more engaging than GTA, just because that was too real to me. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, nothing really popped out. They're going for a level of realism, which is is awesome, it's ambitious.
Yeah.
But, you know, I played, you know, the other game more, because to me it was a lot more fun of an experience, because I had the ability to experiment. Just because I had all these crazy tools at my disposal. And you did a pretty good job with including your pre-made character into the world. So you could make the Hulk, and people would just treat you normal. I thought that was really funny. But I think the problem with open-world games is just like in, we were talking about earlier with JRPGs, there's the lack of urgency, right? Oh god, the world's collapsing, we need you to do this right now, but you need to go to that check marker so you can just like putz around the world forever. Till you feel like coming to this emergency, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's a major problem, and you know, the way that GTA just led the way. They're like, open world games, you need points, story points. And that's just the same model we've been following.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to what we talked about with Alpha Protocol, I think one thing that is a little that we don't really talk about a lot in terms of game design and experience are games where they let you create your own character. Stuff like Mass Effect, or even I think a game I know you like was Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines. I think that's the right one.
Play that this weekend, yes.
Yeah. So, and I think that's very interesting, because in these types of games, the experience itself is loosely defined by the designer, but is refined by the player and how they decide to build their character.
But it's a lot more difficult to have a control over the narrative, which is why most, you know, Eastern games don't like doing that. Like Final Fantasy VII, or there's a lot of Final Fantasy games that let you pick a name for your character, but in the end of the day, they use your last name. So you don't really have to pick anything. It means nothing. But with open world games, I think that you need, as a designer, understand that the narrative is crafted by their play. And you shouldn't constrict them too much, because the more you constrict them, the less open-worldy the game is.
Yeah.
And sometimes people just throw that in there for no reason. Go ahead.
Yeah, man, I think if you do give the player, like, fun toys, you have to make those toys mean something in the world. Like, if you look at a game like Just Cause 2, you had, like, some crazy abilities with the grappling hook and the infinitely launching parachute. And developers built all the game's challenges around that. But if you look at a game Well, like, if you're playing a game like going back to BioShock Infinite for a second, where like we talk about with the whole Skyrail system, that it's such an interesting mechanic, but then it gets dropped for most of the game. So they give you this really fun toy, but then they take it away from you.
Well, it's not really a toy in terms of, you know, something that you can pull out all the time. It's a situational thing.
Mm-hmm.
But because a lot of the time there's a good portion of the game when you're inside buildings. So what do you mm-hmm. do in that situation? You can't. But they took away some interesting vigors, though. Like, I don't know why they took away telekinesis.
Yeah.
I think that would be very helpful. Mm-hmm. Just because, example. And you know what's really weird? It's strange to me that they gave you possession as the first vigor. It's very strange. Because yeah. it's like, oh, you can use this to possess the control people. Why can't they just use it on you?
Definitely.
Like, that's the only vigor you never see used ever again. It's like the strongest vigor of them all, if you think about it. It's kind of silly, but I always thought the Planeteers, everyone says Mati's the weakest with heart, but if he could control any animal, then couldn't he control humans too?
Yeah, technically, yeah.
So he would have the most powerful, because he could just control the other Planeteers and have all the elements, and control people. So, there you go.
Problem solved.
Problem solved. Going back to BioShock Infinite, you know, again, you're right. They had all this stuff given to these vigors, but they gave it to you in a very weird pacing, because they gave you a couple vigors really quickly at the very end, and you had no chance to experiment with them, because you're already kind of set on this, yep. you know, either use all of one or just use two, and that's pretty much it. And choosing the other ones is a pain, because, again, they optimize for consoles, so you can, instead of using number pads to pick which vigor you wanted, you had to press a quick switch. Which, again, they're trying to, you know,
make it easier for consoles or streamline it.
Exactly, streamlining it. And in that case, it hurt the gameplay again. So I think a lot of the gameplay was hurt purely because of marketing and business decisions.
Yeah.
And that sucks.
And I think another thing is that if you try to experiment in BioShock Infinite, it punishes you by the fact that of how expensive the upgrades are. You really have to, if you want to stand a chance playing on hard or higher, you have to really just pick two guns, two plasmids, and say, okay, that's it, I'm not using anything else. Because if you don't, the cost will just be too much and you won't be able to really experiment with them.
Right. And I think if you play on easy, you'll have the ability to experiment. Because there's no challenge, really.
Yeah.
I think that's cool. But that shouldn't be part of the game. But then again, I mean, it's two different perspectives. It's people that want to engage in the experience and just go through it, which is why I see some people, some designers have different difficulties and they change the names up. Sometimes they say, just want the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what BioShock Normal was. Just want the story. And, you know, the gameplay and stuff and the different vigors are just a plus on the side to what they wanted, which was an experience.
Let's see. I think another thing that, going back to the original BioShock, I think one thing that everyone just really didn't like was the good-evil mechanic. And this is another one of those elements of narrative that designers can somewhat force on them. And it just seems so much like when it becomes such a one-way element, that you're not really giving the player freedom, you're just basically locking them into one or two different roles.
Right, and that's a big problem with BioShock 1. That ending was atrocious. And if you just harvest one little sister, you get the bad ending, no matter what. And it's completely binary. And it's, again, it hurts the narrative. It hurts the narrative entirely, because you have to account for this and the different endings.
I was going to go back to have a problem. Finish your thought on BioShock.
But I was saying BioShock Infinite did a lot better job of having one poignant, thought-provoking ending. Go ahead.
Going back to Alpha Protocol, as you said about how BioShock locked in these endings, I think Alpha Protocol did a better job. You had a few, I think you had really just one real ending, or maybe like one major ending, but then there are all these little things that could alter the ending based on how you played. If you were a jerk, if you saved person A, or if you did this action. So while there was an actual end to Alpha Protocol, there's so many little ways that they affected it that it made it more personal to the player.
Right.
And it's the same thing that we saw really in The Walking Dead. Even though the plot through The Walking Dead was 100% linear, but in order to make it personalized, they had these little things that basically remember what you did, or people will call back to that. And while it didn't affect the story in the grand scheme of things, it made more personal to the player.
Right, and I think a game that had a great use of that is Mass Effect 2. That had a game-changing like mechanic at the end. They completely turned it on its head. Because let me just say that the last mission is a suicide mission. And there's a lot of sacrifice that has to be done during that mission. That's, you know, pulls at your heartstring because you're so engaged with these characters. Which is why everyone hates Mass Effect 3 so much, because what happened in Mass Effect 3? Even you played it, though, right?
I did not.
But you know the controversy, though, right?
Yeah.
Three colors.
Yeah.
What do you think? Exactly. So you have such a poignant ending for 2, and then you have a terrible choice. Like, not even choice. You have a terrible limited choice of how you want to ruin your game experience at the end of Mass Effect 3.
What did you think about Deus Ex Human Revolution's, you know, three-button ending? Like, well, similar concept.
Still better than the Mass Effect 3 ending. Because that had two games behind it of great build-up, great world. Deus Ex just ran out of time. By the way, Deus Ex, the DLC for that game, what was it called? The Missing Link?
Human Revolution. Oh, yeah,
The Missing Link. That did it right. The boss of that game, you could take him out stealthily. You could just, like, jump on him and kill him. It's perfect. And the reason why, and the thing is that with that game, it explained that ending too. Because in the ending of Deus Ex Human Revolution, let's just say you're in a room full of things that you were never introduced to at all. Like, at all. So you're just like, what is this place? Why is this happening? I understand nothing. Okay, boss battle time? Alright. So, the Missing Link actually links them together. It kind of explains how that boss battle even came to be at the end of Deus Ex Human Revolution. And the button thing, I think it's just brought over from the original Deus Ex with the multiple factions. Mm-hmm. I think that was a problem. There's a lot of good sequels that pull in this motifs from the originals just because they want to tie it closer together. I think that is an issue that they should just try to get away with. Just stand on your own set, you know, your own design. You don't need to pander. I think that's what Deus Ex did.
Alright, so let's wrap things up, and I guess the best way to end this kind of debate is with, you know, final thoughts. So, what's your final thoughts on our little debate?
Well, first, I think this was a fun experiment. I think we should bring in a third person in the future, and also do it a little earlier when I'm not so tired. but I would say that gameplay, any medium, is a type of escapism, right?
Yeah.
So we play it to, you know, alleviate stress, or if you have free time, etc., etc. But you want experiencing something different than your normal life. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think experience is very important to gameplay, or any medium, again. And I think that's why BioShock Infinite and games like it that are ambitious deserves extra credit. Mm-hmm. Because they're giving you something you would not be able to engage before. What I mean by that is that they're giving you experience that wasn't felt before. And they're pushing the medium. I think that's always good to do.
Yeah.
Because you could have the best cover-based shooter game in the world, but in the end of the day, you're just another cover-based shooter game.
Mm-hmm.
With BioShock Infinite, they crafted you a very perplexing and interesting world with a windy and twisty narrative that provoked a lot of argument, discussion, thoughts, and I think about it every day to a degree. It has a great soundtrack, etc. Just little things make me remember the game and make me think about the concepts of parallels, the concept of nationalism, religion, And things that parallel to our current lives in America, and if things are taken too far, what it could look like.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, yeah, and let's just say gameplay. But gameplay itself is still important. Yes, definitely, of course. But in the service of Bioshock, I don't think that it hurt my experience. When a gameplay actually hurts my experience, that's when the game gets hard to get docked. Like, those boss battles in Deus Ex and Alpha Protocol, those happen. I hated it.
I think for me, in terms of experience, I see it as looking at the game as a whole. The sound, art, how the game plays. And I think that when you're trying to examine a game, it's best to look at the experience through all angles of it. If you try to put one element too high up on a pedestal, you're going to ignore or undervalue the other aspects of it. And the games that I enjoy the best are ones that every aspect of the game clicks. There's no, like, mechanic conflict or general just weirdness of how the game plays out. If there are any issues, they are overshadowed by what the game did right, as evident with, you know, the buying of Isaac, FTL, or Xenoblade Chronicles. These were games that designers knew what they wanted to do, and they designed the game from the bottom up to hit all those points. It wasn't a game that was designed for mass appeal, obviously, but they knew what they wanted, and they designed it in such a way. And as we talked about with Bioshock Infinite, I think that was definitely a case where focus testing, I think, did more harm than good. Because they took the scan, they tried to basically smooth out all the edges to make it appeal more, but I think in the end, it hurt the game more because of that.
Right. And just to talk about, and just quickly go on my point about the concept of experience, a lot of games go for realism, like Bulletstorm, right? To a degree, mm-hmm. in terms of their environments and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's, in the end of the day, it's so forgettable. But Bioshock Infinite and Bioshock 1 crafted a world, had a fantastic art style that'll stand even to future gamers, too. They'll look back on it and be like, wow, they really did their research.
All right. So we're going to end here. And if you are listening, you would like us to do more of these head-to-heads in the future, definitely let us know in the comments or send us an email. And as always, if you would like to write a piece for Game Wisdom or be a future guest on our podcast, send us an email through the submissions warrant link. So I would like to thank Ken for once again being on.
You got it.
And we're going to end it here. We will talk to you again next week, and have a great weekend, everybody.